Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm Douglas Impoga in Washington. Today is Monday, October 9th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Liberians prepare to go to the polls Tuesday to elect their 26th president and members of the 55th legislature.
There's a major threat for those countries that are allies of Israel and the United States more broadly. So, for example, if you take the case of Kenya and Tanzania in East Africa, Kenya has a lot of investment from Israel. We've had terrorist attacks on Israeli tourist hotels in the past.
Israeli airstrikes kill more than 370 people in Gaza, including children, after Hamas fighters rampaged through Israel towns, killing more than 600 and abducting dozens more.
We saw that when it came to floods, it was Somalia and South Sudan that actually had the highest number of child displacements relative to the population. So we saw that there was equivalent to 12% for South Sudan and 11% for Somalia.
And the UN says storms, floods, and other extreme weather events led to more than 43 million displaced people, involving children between 2016 and 2021. Those stories, plus Samson Omale's sports, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Two Israeli tourists and the Egyptian guide were shot dead on Sunday in the Egyptian city of Alexandria, according to the Israeli Foreign Ministry. Reuters reports a policeman alleged to have carried out the shooting in the Sawari district of Alexandria was in custody. The shooting happened one day after an assault against Israel by Islamist group Hamas, for which Israel vowed mighty vengeance in response. Hundreds of Palestinians and Israelis have been killed. Egypt was the first Arab nation to normalize relations with Israel, but while the two countries cooperate closely on security and energy, many Egyptians, like others across the Arab world, continue to sympathize with the Palestinian cause. Reuters says on Sunday, Israel airstrikes killed more than 370 people in Gaza, including children, after Hamas fighters rummaged through Israel towns, killing 600 and abducting dozens more, threatening a major new Middle East war. For more on the impact of this conflict, I reached political analyst David Monda.
I think it's very serious on a whole range of levels because, number one, it recreates this tension in the Middle East when it appeared that Israel was reconciling with a lot of its Arab neighbors and the Arab community more broadly. We had relations with Saudi Arabia, Turkey, Morocco, United Arab Emirates being reconciled or being improved. But I think more importantly, also in terms of the global economy, as it relates to Africa, anytime you have these conflicts between Israel and the Palestinians, you affect global maritime chains and maritime choke points. So by that, I mean areas like the Straits of Hormuz in the Persian Gulf, shipping around the Red Sea, the Mediterranean, and the Suez Canal. So anytime you have these tensions, insurance rates on shipping go up, access to oil, global oil supply goes up. So the demand is higher and the supply is reduced, especially now with other situations like in Ukraine and so on and so forth. The challenge for that then is Africa will be directly affected because our economies rely on oil and the price of oil is already extremely high. What this is going to do is raise the price higher because of the uncertainty it creates. So I think for Africa, that would then affect the prices of basic goods and services. It will affect the growth of the economies, and ultimately it will also hurt the common consumer on the continent and the world more broadly. So I think that's the other major challenge. But I think lastly, it also affects, there's a major threat for those countries that are allies of Israel and the United States more broadly. So for example, if you take the case of Kenya and Tanzania in East Africa, Kenya has a lot of investment from Israel. We've had terrorist attacks on Israeli tourist hotels in the past, in Lamu, for example. We know about the 1998 terrorist bombings of the U.S. embassy because the U.S. was perceived to be an ally of Israel and Osama bin Laden targeted them. So there's also a threat for a rise of these jihadi movements through, for example, Somalia to attack U.S. interests in Africa. So I think that's also a major problem when you have these tensions in the Middle East.
To many people, this flaring up of this conflict was a surprise. And Israel had been trying to make inroads with the Abraham Accords. But now what we are hearing from some of those North African and Middle Eastern countries, the tone doesn't seem quite encouraging.
It doesn't. Because there's obviously a huge pressure within the Arab community to stand by the Palestinians. As we know, these attacks have really been instituted in the occupied region, you know, of the Gaza Strip, and they targeted settler communities, those settler holdouts that bordered Gaza, which is, you know, mainly Palestinian neighborhoods. That really opens up this age-old question of what is the long-term fate of these occupied regions that are held by Israel, particularly after the 1967 Arab-Israeli conflict, that those occupied regions. Because we have to also remember that this was done very strategically by Hamas, because it's around this period when we had the Yom Kippur War of 1973. So almost 50 years later, this was very strategic to remind the Israelis and remind the global community that this conflict is still very much alive. I must also say that it also raises the bigger problem of how to deal with Hamas, the group that's responsible for these attacks, because Hamas, like Hezbollah in Lebanon, has received a lot of support and training from Iran as a proxy of Iran. So the Iranian hand is also, I'm sure, very much involved in these attacks in terms of providing intelligence, in terms of providing the coordination of how to infiltrate the settler fencing, to infiltrate the Israeli intelligence, and also to provide the gunmen with weapons to attack the Israelis. But also for the Israeli army, this is a major threat because now they have to go door to door in the Gaza Strip in an urban area. And there's a high likelihood that the hostages that Hamas has taken may get killed. A lot of Palestinians will get killed. But more broadly, this is a conflict that could bring in a lot of the regional powers and escalate the situation. So it's really a very difficult situation at this point.
That's Dave Monda, a political analyst and professor of political science at the City University of New York. And tomorrow, Tuesday, October 10th, Liberians go to the polls to elect their 26th president and members of the 55th legislature as mandated by the Constitution. Denise Nimpson has more from Monrovia.
Liberia is holding its fourth post-war presidential and legislative elections in which incumbent George Weah is seeking a second six-year term. For the legislative elections, there are 73 seats up for grabs in the House of Representatives with six-year terms. In the Senate, there are 15 of the 30 seats up for grabs, each serving nine-year terms. In the presidential vote, there are 20 candidates with two females, one of which is an independent candidate. The major candidates to look out for are incumbent George Manning Weah of the Coalition for Democratic Change, Joseph Yuman Boakai of the main opposition Unity Party, businessman Alexander Benedict Cummings of the Alternative National Congress under the umbrella of the collaborating political parties, and human rights lawyer Councillor Tiawan Gunglu of the Liberian People's Party. However, the forerunners of the elections are Weah and Boakai. The key issues include jobs, the state of economy and education, healthcare, illegal drugs, accountability issues, including corruption, the rule of law, governance. Weah, in his inaugural speech in 2018, vowed to transform the lives of Liberians with the statement that Liberians will not be spectators in their own economy, an expectation that critics say did not happen. Also, critics say a plan to establish a war crimes court has failed. The national budget increased from $570 million in 2018 to $783 million though most of it was allocated to recurring expenditures such as government salaries. It also included projected growth based on resource extraction without value addition. Now the question is whether to maintain we are who critics believe perform poorly to the extent that the U.S. sanctioned three of his top officials for corruption. Voters can also choose the opposition who many believe have not been able to sustain a united bloc. The main challenger to WIA, former VP Boakai, has been criticized for his lack of leadership, evidenced by the breakdown of CPP, the collaborating political parties, which was under his watch as the rotating leader. Critics are also skeptical about his alliance with former warlord and current Senator Prince Johnson. The U.S. Treasury Department has sanctioned him for his alleged involvement in pay-for-play funding scheme with the national government. The proclamation or claim of one-round victory by the Coalition for Democratic Change and the Unity Party is something to look out for. Both parties may claim early victory even without an official declaration by the National Elections Commission. Observers say this could be a strategy to instill fear. For VOA's Daybreak Africa, I'm Denise Nipsey in Monrovia, Liberia.
Today, Ugandans mark 61 years of independence. The main celebrations will be held in the northern district of Kitgum, where President Museveni is expected to preside. Isaac Semakade is a political analyst and founder and CEO at the law firm Legal Brains Trust. He tells me most Ugandans are more concerned about other issues like the economic situation and rampant corruption.
I don't see any excitement about Independence Day. This particular Independence Day, maybe there is a small class of people that have to participate in the usual government caravan, which will be somewhere in northern Uganda in Kitgum. But here in Kampala and other cities and trading centers, the mood is very low. People are concerned about extreme economic hardship. That has been the major theme since the beginning of the year. They have little reason for excitement and reflection on Independence Day.
Politically, Uganda has never had a peaceful transfer of power. And as we speak now, one of the political leaders is under house arrest. How does that impact the celebrations?
I think it cements the general sense of desperation and frustration with the absence of freedom, of prosperity, and all the common hopes that independence was supposed to represent through the generation of the leaders that the current president is among. So it's quite telling that President Museveni is the closest, I think is the last vestige of the leaders that were there at independence, and he has very little accountability to offer Ugandans at this time. I think there's a general feeling of frustration and anger at the Museveni government because people are aware of how much time has been lost and how much will have to be done. And incarceration and house arrest situation of the current opposition leader, it's not that it's new. It's just that this is so common. These events have punctuated political life in Uganda for the last 35 years. And everybody else is enveloped in this pressure cooker, you know, of our politics. And at some point, something is going to give, but our politics has stagnated so badly that we need a whole new conversation out of this stagnation. And our leaders, even those in the opposition, have failed to really speak the truth that Ugandans need to face, especially around independence. There were many unresolved questions at the time of independence, which the independence leaders ignored, and even the current crop of leaders, both in government and opposition, continue to ignore, and they just fight for positions in government. But the people know these issues, and those unresolved issues continue to reflect the fissures in our politics.
Most Ugandans today were not there at independence. What are the aspirations now?
The first one, I think, currently is equitable participation in government, I think for most Ugandans, it's very clear that the governance infrastructure that we have in place serves only the rulers and their favored groups and not the people at large. So people are aspiring for a corrupt-free government that can provide opportunity for people to thrive in their own homeland, in their lifetime. Person and excessive government interference in people's lives, which has aided them out of opportunities that could have improved their situation. So that's a sort of concern right now.
That's Isaac Semakade, political analyst and founder and CEO at the law firm Legal Brains Trust. He spoke with me from Kampala. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm Douglas Mpuga in Washington. The UN says storms, floods, and other extreme weather events led to more than 43 million displaced people, including children, between 2016 and 2021. UNICEF estimates that more than 113 million children will be displaced over the next 3 decades. The UNICEF report takes into account risks from flooded rivers, high winds from cyclones, and floods that come after storm. Laura Haley is a migration specialist at UNICEF and one of the report's authors. She tells VOA's Caro Van Dam that far more children are going to be affected in the coming years as the impacts of climate change intensify.
So we looked at past weather-related displacement between 2016 and 2021 and identified there were 43.1 million internal displacements of children due to floods, storms, droughts, and wildfire. So this is the equivalent to 20,000 child displacements every day.
In the Horn of Africa in particular, there's a lot of children that have been displaced due to floods, you know, drought, all kinds of things, conflict too. Can you describe that a little bit?
Yeah, so when we looked at the absolute numbers of child displacement, there were 3 countries that stood out, which were China, India, and the Philippines. And this is really due to a number of reasons. Firstly, the location where they are, it's high risk for weather-related events and disasters. Secondly, there's a really high child population. But when we looked at the findings relative to the child population, we actually saw a very different story. We saw that when it came to floods, it was Somalia and South Sudan that actually had the highest number of child displacements relative to the population. So we saw that there was equivalent to 12% for South Sudan and 11% for Somalia. It really shone a light on the countries where there are not the same preemptive evacuations and preparedness measures in place, and highlights this is where the risk may be even greater for children when it comes to weather-related displacement now, but also in the future as the impacts of climate change intensify.
And when you talk about the Horn of Africa, it's even worse, isn't it? Because they go to these neighboring countries, like into Sudan, there's conflict. Ethiopia is even a neighboring country of South Sudan, so there's not much relief there.
That's right. So what the data did look at was specifically internal displacement, so children who have moved within their own countries as a result of weather-related events. But what the analysis really showed us is that it is in those countries where climate risks intersect with conflict, with fragility, with generalized violence, with poverty, where the risk is actually the greatest, where it's more difficult to prepare for the impacts of climate change and growing numbers of displaced children.
Did UNICEF come up with any kinds of recommendations or solutions in this report?
Yes, so as we move towards the big climate change conference in Dubai in just a matter of weeks, we are really calling for governments, for donors, for private sector, for affected communities and children and young people themselves to come together to protect children and young people at risk of climate change and displacement through ensuring that the services and the systems that children rely on, so education, child protection, healthcare, WASH services.
That's Laura Haley, a migration specialist at UNICEF and one of the report's authors. She spoke with my colleague, Caro Van Dam. It's now time for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson Omali in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Monday morning to you, Samson.
Good Monday morning to you too, Douglas. We begin the sports with athletics. Kenyan Kelvin Kiptum broke the marathon world record in sensational fashion at the 2023 Chicago Marathon on Sunday in a time of 2 hours, 35 seconds. The 23-year-old shattered the old world record of 2 hours, 1 minute, 9 seconds set by Kenya's Eliud Kipchoge to win the 2022 Berlin Marathon. It was Kiptum's third victory in as many starts over the 26.2-mile distance. He won on his debut last December at Valencia and then in London Marathon last April. It marked the third time a men's world record had been set on the streets of Chicago, but the first time since Morocco's Khalid Kanouchi in 1999.
I feel so happy. A world record was not in my mind today, but it has come definitely. But I knew one day, one time, I'll be a world record holder.
In basketball news, the qualifying campaign for the fourth edition of the Basketball African League took place across various venues, with the first round of the Road to Bal campaign concluding in early November with the Elite 16. In Group B, host Forces Armies at Police FAP of Cameroon won their first game of the Road to Bal after trouncing Lamanite 61-12 on Sunday in Yaoundé. It was an uncharacteristic event as the Chadian champions, who trailed 33-3 at the end of the opening quarter, refused to resume the game after halftime, forcing the officiating team to conclude the game. No official explanation was given as to what's going to happen next to the Chadian champions. Elsewhere, Cospin of Madagascar qualified for the Elite 16 of the Road to Bal 2024 by seeing of Bouvalon Heat of Seychelles 76-57 in a one-sided game on Sunday. Cospin of Madagascar will fly to Johannesburg later this month in a bid to reach the Bal final round. In cricket news, history was made at the ICC World Cup taking place in India as Aiden Makram hit the fastest World Cup century in ICC World Cup history in the 102-run victory over Sri Lanka in Delhi. South Africa sent in to bat after losing the toss pulverized the Sri Lankan attack to record the highest total in World Cup history of 428-5 in their 50 overs. Makram, in his post-match interview, said he was excited to make a history without really planning for it.
It worked luckily tonight. Balls hit gaps. I mean, they don't always hit gaps, and could be a different story. But yeah, thankful it worked out that way. And again, it was a really good pitch, so that definitely assisted.
In tennis news, world number 7 Tunisian Ons Jabeur has been exempted from the first round of the WTA 500 tournament, Zhengzhou Open in China, which begins on Monday. And that's it for this Monday's edition of Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, Douglas, in Washington.
Thanks, Samson. Have a very good Monday. And that's it for this Monday, October 9th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for beginning your week with us. For more African news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms, including Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are also on YouTube, where you can watch our TV shows, Africa 54, Straight Talk Africa, and Red Carpet. On behalf of the entire Daybreak Africa crew, I'm Douglas Impuga in Washington, wishing you a very good week.
The first African summit held in Kenya has concluded with the Nairobi Declaration calling for world leaders to ensure large-scale financing for climate-related investments and debt relief. This week's Our Voices will look at African women's role in protecting their environment and ask experts for ways their voices are represented in the global fight against climate change. Join